The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Margaret Bartley presiding. God bless the United States and this honorable court.
Good afternoon, everyone. After a bit of a delay, we are ready to start the argument. I'm joined today via video conference by Judge Peach and Judge Greenberg. And we're here today for the matter of Michelle M. Bolds versus Dennis McDonough, docket number 22-2484. Counsel for the parties, please state your name and your appearance for the record, beginning with appellant's counsel.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Jonathan Davis, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Ms. Michelle Bolds.
Very good, Mr. Davis. Welcome. And Secretary's counsel?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Jonathan Veterans Affairs. With me today is Deputy Chief Counsel Sarah Fusina.
Very good, Mr. Scruggs and Ms. Fusina, welcome. And Mr. Davis, I understand you would like to reserve 5 minutes.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and we will make that happen, and you may begin when you're ready.
Chief Judge Bartley, Judge Peach, Judge Greenberg. May it please the court. Michelle Bolds is a U.S. Air Force veteran that is stuck in the VA's hamster wheel. In May 2021, the board denied her appeals on the board's hearing docket, including several claims for some gynecological conditions. She appealed to this court, hired me to represent her, and prepared arguments for a Rule 33 briefing conference. At the conference, the secretary offered to enter into a joint motion for partial remand only for Ms. Bold's gynecological condition claims because the board ignored favorable relevant medical evidence when it denied those claims. The secretary only conceded error on the gynecological claims, and Ms. Bold's had to agree to waive this court's consideration of the other issues to accept the secretary's offer. As part of the offer, the secretary agreed that Ms. Bolds could submit additional evidence to the board on remand. Ms. Bolds accepted the deal. On remand, she submitted additional evidence. The board then found that the Appeals Modernization Act prohibited it from reviewing the evidence she submitted because the AMA contains temporal limitations on her right to submit additional evidence. The board reneged on the deal she made with the secretary. We are here today to ask this court to find that a deal is a deal. This court should vacate and reverse the board's finding of law about its power to review the evidence Ms. Bold submitted on remand.
Now, Mr. Davis, I see that on, I believe it was December 21st, 2021, the board sent her a letter. This was shortly after the court's remand, and told her specifically, in apparent disregard of the JMR, that she could submit argument but not evidence post-remand at the board. Now, did she challenge that at all? Did she write to the board or call the board's attention to the terms of the JMR at that point?
Your Honor, she didn't specifically mention the terms of the JMR, but she did submit the additional evidence in response to the board's letter that they sent her and mentioned that the JMR did allow that.
Okay, so she didn't respond to the December 21 letter.
She did not directly respond to that letter, no, Your Honor. But when she did submit her arguments and evidence following the remand, it implicitly could be viewed as a response to that letter. But she did not directly mention that letter in her post-remand arguments.
Thank you.
Now, the first argument.
Just a minute. Sorry to interrupt. This is Judge Greenberg. Did you submit the Taylor case as a supplement to your application?
Yes, Your Honor, I did.
Would you tell the court how we are to apply Taylor to the facts of this situation?
Yes, Your Honor. In Taylor, the Federal Circuit held in VA's favor for 2 points, but they held in Mr. Taylor's favor for 1 point. And that's the salient point that the court should look at here when analyzing Ms. Bold's claim for procedural due process. She argued that the board violated her right to procedural due process because it eliminated her ability to have a meaningful opportunity to be heard on remand. Taylor found 38 U.S.C. section 1110 unconstitutional as it applied to Mr. Taylor. And the court can use that same rationale when finding the constitution, when finding the statutory provision that limited Ms. Bold's right to submit additional evidence. The court can find that the provision of the AMA that set the temporal limitation is constitutionally defective as it applies only to Ms. Bold's case, where the secretary agrees that despite what's written in the AMA, she has that right to submit additional evidence.
Thank you. Go ahead.
The first main point that we need to discuss this morning is that the secretary had the statutory authority to require the board to consider this additional evidence despite the temporal limitations set forth in the AMA. The court looked no further than 38 U.S.C. section 7112 small a. That statute states, and I read, the secretary shall take such actions as may be necessary to provide for the expeditious treatment by the board of any claim that is remanded to the secretary by this board. When viewed in the overall veteran-friendly context of the appeal system, the court should interpret this statute in a manner that gives the secretary flexibility to tailor remand orders in this court to ensure that the case is expedited and receives a final decision in an expedited manner. The AMA, when it was passed, it did not overrule 38 U.S.C. section 7112. In fact, if you look at the procedural history that Congress relied on when it was passing and considering to pass the AMA, the Senate cited a similar statute when mentioning that VA still had this authority to do anything it needed to do to expedite resolution of an appeal following remand from this court. And you can find that in Senate Report 115-126 at pages 9 to 10, where they cite 38 U.S.C. section 5109 large B.
Counsel, sorry to interrupt. What is it that you think or that your client thinks they got by way of a deal or a contract or an agreement in the JMR that they didn't get? Could you just be a bit more precise?
I don't understand your question.
What is it that she thought she was getting with this agreed upon order, the JMR, that she That's didn't true. Get? What didn't she get?
Your Honor, the purpose of the JMR was to remand the appeal so that the board could consider the clinical significance of the term reactive squamous metaplasia. This term was contained on a service treatment record from 1987 that the board completely ignored and that Ms. Bolds had no idea existed before she hired me to represent her at this court. What she thought she received in this deal was the opportunity to submit evidence to the board to explain the clinical significance of that term.
And she didn't get that?
She did not get that.
And that's because the board, in your view, erroneously applied this later statute. to this factual situation?
Yes, Your Honor, and it caused the board to make a mistake of fact when it decided the case. And because of the mistake of law that it's making, the board cannot correct this mistake of fact until your court steps in to decide that, yes, she had the power to submit this evidence.
Mr. Davis, in your initial brief, you started out by pointing out that she had chosen the hearing docket. And you were, I believe, making the argument that there were looser evidentiary rules for the hearing docket, but you didn't really flesh it out a lot. Can you just talk about that a little bit? I think you might have been distinguishing her case from the Andrews case, et cetera, but apart from Andrews, is there some significance to the fact that she is in the board hearing docket?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think you need to look at the special purposes of the direct review docket when looking at Andrews to determine the difference between the direct review docket, like in Andrews, and the hearing docket in this case.
Well, what should they have done on remand since she was in the hearing docket? And I believe that there is a regulation that says that whenever you get a court remand, you will be returned to the docket that you were in initially before you appealed to the court.
Yes, Your Honor.
Does that impact here?
No, Your Honor, because Ms. Bowles isn't trying to, she's not trying to change dockets following the remand. She was on the hearing. She was on the hearing track before she appealed to the court. When the court authorized the December 2021 JMPR, she should have been placed back in the same position she was in when she filed her NOD. This is an issue that arose during the oral arguments in Andrews, where the court struggled with the idea of what happens following a remand from this court. Are we back in the same position we are when we file the NOD? Or do we pretend that the 90-day window from the hearing lane passed after where the court goes back? In Ms. Bold's case, because of the agreement she struck with the secretary, the court should find that the secretary's position is that after a remand from this court, the veteran goes back to day one when the court remands it, and the NOD starts over. The appellant, should they choose, they should be able to request a new hearing, and they should be able to submit new evidence following the hearing lane, especially in cases such as this, where the error that was caused by the board was evidence that the board never considered, the veteran never knew existed, and has a tremendous weight on the ultimate outcome of the appeal. The veteran needs justice demands that the veteran.
Mr. Davis, if I can interrupt you. So yeah. You're saying that she should have been able to request a hearing? Is that?
Because she
returned to the board hearing docket.
Yes, Your Honor. She should have been given that right should she wanted to, but right. She did not request that in this case.
And what's the regulation that says that she could do that? I just want to point out, this is very different from the other dockets, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And there's no regulation on point to that. But the court, when determining whether she should have been given the opportunity to request another hearing, the court should look at Cook v. Snyder, a decision from this court from 2017. In that case, the court
that was a pre-AMA case, but there is a regulation 20.700A that applies specifically to the hearing docket at the board and says that you get one hearing on appeal, but that requests for additional board hearings may be granted for good cause. Do you think that the JMR in this case was good cause?
Yes, Your Honor, because It highlighted evidence that was before the board and needed to be explained before a final resolution on this appeal could happen.
And the letter, the December 21 letter that I referred to earlier, did that tell her that she could get another hearing?
No, Your Honor.
And have the chance to submit not only argument, but in addition, evidence?
No, Your Honor. It did not say that.
And are you saying that if it had told her that, she would have, you know, availed herself of that?
No, Your Honor. We would not have in this case.
She would not have. And why is that?
Your Honor, because the factual issue that we submitted evidence to support is not an issue that lay evidence would be able to help. We need medical evidence. We submitted medical treatise evidence to explain the clinical significance of a rare medical term.
Yes, but on if she had another hearing with the ability to submit not only argument but evidence, she would be able to submit any kind of evidence, not just lay evidence. Is that correct, or is that your understanding?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. But you were just saying that you wouldn't have asked for, if she had been informed that being in the hearing docket, she could get another hearing to submit not only argument, but also evidence. You were saying she wouldn't have availed herself of that. You were saying she wouldn't have because she could only submit lay evidence?
No, Your Honor. The factual issue that we need to discuss is not an issue where lay evidence would help. So we strategically would not have requested a hearing in order to.
Okay, I'm getting confused then, or you are. If she got a hearing, she would not be limited to submitting lay evidence. She would be able to submit any kind of evidence. Is that your understanding? I mean, that's my understanding.
Yes, Your Honor, but you can submit medical treatise evidence without having to go to a hearing, which is what she chose to do in this
okay
case.
So that's her position. She wouldn't have wanted to wait in line for a hearing, or what?
Wait in line, waste resources, however you would like to frame it, but it was basically the delay involved, which is why she did not want another hearing after
I
she hired
okay. But she never got notice that she could have the opportunity to submit any kind of evidence if she requested another hearing for good cause.
No, Your Honor, and I don't know that that would matter because she's represented by counsel, and I would have the duty to make sure that she's aware of that. And we made a strategic decision in this case that she did not need to go through the wait of requesting another. Given the fact that this December 2021 JMR explicitly granted her the right to submit written evidence.
And Mr. Davis, there is some language in the JMPR. I assume this is language that the secretary inserted, but of course, not having been involved in the JMR process, I can't be sure. There is this sentence: any statements made herein shall not be construed as statements of policy or the interpretation of any statute, regulation, or policy by the secretary. Does that have any import here?
Honestly, Your Honor, I would say that that's boilerplate language that should pretty much be disregarded as it applies to the facts of Ms. Bold's case. We're here and we're trying to keep our position narrow to the point that it only affects her and the deal that she received and the decision she received, without broadening this to a systemic issue that affects all veterans and all hearing lanes. And if we were to use the JMR in that manner to argue that the secretary has completely changed his policy on how it reviews evidence going back after remand, I think that would be improper. But arguing about the effect of that JMR, which affects this case, I don't think is improper, and it does not violate the terms of that agreement.
Uh-huh. Well, to be frank, I saw that statement as possibly helping her, not hurting her, and not as broadening anything here. But it, because it says any statement made herein, and the statement they made, which was that Kucharewski would apply in her individual case. This, what you're saying is boilerplate, says any statement, such as the Kucharewski statement here, shall not be construed as interpreting a statute or a regulation by the Secretary.
Yes, Your Honor.
And Mr. Davis, oh, go ahead.
No, please, Your Honor.
Is there a, as you know, the Secretary has made arguments that he cannot apply the terms of the JMR here because it is there's a statutory bar to doing so. Is the fact that this that 7113B, which applies here, is the fact that that is more of a procedural rather than substantive statute, does that have any impact?
Your Honor, I researched this issue and I did not find that it made any impact, whether it's procedural or substantive in this manner. You know, Ms. Bolds is arguing that it was her procedural rights that were affected. Substantively, she still had the right to submit evidence for her appeal. And the rule deals with the procedures of it, and we never really touched on, you know, any substantive law arguments. We're only focused on the procedure here.
Right. And so my question was the fact that it is procedural and not substantive, or appears to be procedural, does that impact the Secretary's argument that he cannot, this cannot be, that 7113B cannot be waived, cannot be, you know, messed with in any way?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that's where 7112A comes in, which is the statute that gives the Secretary the flexibility to, you know, make changes to the procedure under after the court remands it in order to expedite a final resolution of the appeal.
Right. And in your view, 7112 does not deal only with speeding up the consideration of an appeal at the board post remand. It deals with something other than, something in addition to speeding up the remanded case?
Yes, Your Honor. I read it to mean that the Secretary has flexibility in tailoring the remand orders and to responding to the remand orders from this court to do whatever actions it takes necessary. The statute says such actions as may be necessary.
Yes, but then it says to provide for expeditious treatment by the board.
Yes, Your Honor. And I read that phrase to include the fact that the Secretary has to do what is needed to make sure that the case does not come back to this court. Take whatever steps need to take to ensure that the hamster wheel does not continue after this court issues a decision. When you look at this court's statement that it submitted to the statement when Chief Judge Davis provided testimony in 2017, the understanding was that the AMA was not going to change how this court operated. And here we are a few years later, and exactly what happens is we're trying to limit the ability for appellants who come to this court to tailor remands individual to the circumstances of their case that can help the case get to a final resolution without coming back. In oral arguments in Andrews, it was discussed about Congress's intent with the relationship between the court and the board when it comes to dealing with remand orders from this court. And the court seemed to indicate that Congress's intent on this issue was clear. And I think the court should find that that's not true. If you look at every statement that a stakeholder submitted either to the House of Representatives Veterans Affairs Committee or to the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee in response to the proposed AMA legislation, no one, not a single stakeholder, including the VA and including this court, mentioned the issue of what happens after a remand from this court. The intent of Congress at best was vague, but Congress expressed its intent to continue the veteran-friendly appeals nature of our system and expressed an intent to keep the court business as usual. And that's what I think the court should do in this case. Find that Ms. Bolts had the ability to submit this evidence because the secretary agreed she could. And it's fundamentally unfair for the board to tell higher court what it can and cannot put in its remand. Your honors, I see I'm running out of time. If you have no further questions for me at this point, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Let's add
5 minutes.
Okay, thank you. I misunderstand you when you said a little earlier that your position is that Miss Bowles should be able to start from, I think you used the term square one. Are you saying that this case should go all the way back to, I think it was September 19th when Ms. Bowles chose the hearing category of on the appeals on her NOD? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. Back to day one when she filed her notice of disagreement. To be clear, not to day one when she filed the claim, but to day one when she filed the NOD.
And if she filed her NOD, which would have been September 2019.
Yes, Your Honor. At that date, she had the ability to have a hearing in the future and to submit evidence after that hearing.
Oh, as opposed to what is where you would just take up the case where it was left off before the JMR?
Yes, Your Honor. As opposed to the case returning to the board from the court and the board treating that case as has already been pending for 3 or 4 years, however long it takes from the filing of an NOD to a resolution of the case in this court. The board should consider that, okay, there were errors in the first adjudication of this appeal. The appellant gets another chance to fix the errors of that adjudication.
But Mr. Davis, I hate to interrupt Judge Peach. Let me just have Mr. Davis clarify. But I asked earlier whether if the board letter that she received had said you can have another hearing, you would have said no. And now I thought that you just told Judge Peach that you want to start back at square one with the opportunity to have a hearing and submit evidence.
Yes, Your Honor. That's still true. She still would have said no, but she still should have been given that right to go back to day one following the NOD. Instead of her case being treated as though, the only thing that happened was that the court said you have to fix this little error, we'll pencil whip it and get it right back up to the denial stage. She should have been given the opportunity to relitigate the issues in her case before the board made a final decision.
Well, I'm sorry for the interruption, Judge Peach, did you have any additional questions?
No, not at this time. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And Judge Greenberg?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Davis, you may wrap it up very quickly.
Yes, Your Honor. I'll save my conclusion for rebuttal.
Okay, great. And Mr. Scruggs, you may begin.
Chief Judge Barley, Judge Peach, and Judge Greenberg, Good afternoon, and may it please the court. The secretary submits that the court should vacate the April 22nd, 2022 board decision and remand all the issues consistent with the secretary's concession of error contained in his brief submitted to the court on February 2nd, 2023. Specifically, the court should find that the board failed to address relevant portions of appellant's testimony presented at her January 2021 hearing before the board. The court, however, should decline to include any additional bases for remand because appellant's arguments fail to otherwise show error or prejudice in the board's decision. The secretary presumes, and I think the conversation thus far confirms, that we are here today because of the mistake his counsel made in inputting incorrect boilerplate language in the December 2021 joint motion for partial remand. The secretary owns that mistake, apologizes for that mistake, and regrets that the mistake was not discovered at a time when it could have been rectified. However, that mistake cannot create a right where it is contrary to statute and regulation. And even when viewing all of the underlying issues in a light most favorable to appellant, her argument cannot meet her burden of demonstrating prejudicial error given the procession of her November 2021 supplemental claim. And with that, Your Honor, I'll just like to start on one point that you raised, Chief Judge Bartley, regarding the record here. You raised the December 2021 letter by the board. As you correctly noted, that letter did inform appellant that new evidence should not be submitted and that new evidence would not be considered. Appellant did respond to that letter. The evidence and letter sent by appellant in January 2022 was captioned response to that 90-day letter. And nowhere in that response did appellant raise the issue of the letter being in conflict with any instruction of the JMR. That was never raised in that letter, and that was never raised to the board at any point before the decision on appeal.
Right, but I believe Mr. Davis's point was that he did submit additional evidence, seemingly an implicit disagreement with the contents of the board letter as regards new evidence.
Yes, Your Honor. But it did not explicitly make any argument with respect to the board saying explicitly that any new evidence submitted would not be considered. But when we look at the two points that appellant is trying to raise and trying to distinguish the case, the court's case law speaks clearly to the issue. The first issue being whether or not 38 U.S.C. 7113 speaks to what happens on remand. The court clearly in Andrews said that that question was answered, that the answer is yes, that the statute does speaks to what happens on remand, that when Congress legislated that particular statute, it did so knowing very well that the court remands cases, and it still decided that that was how the evidentiary record was supposed to go.
Well, I mean, you know, Secretary's counsel knew that when they drafted the JMR, and the 90-day, the Kucharewski language made it in. So although Congress, of course, and the court in Andrews indicated that 7113 applied on remand, yes, but that case did not speak to the question at issue here, which is what if the secretary, whether it was deliberate or not, signed an agreement.
Yes, Your Honor.
This individual appellant would be able to submit additional evidence.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, that moves us to another portion of the court's case law, which is Forciere. Forciere says when we're looking at the provisions of a joint motion for remand, that when the question of substantial compliance is raised, which is the very question the court is faced with here, the very, very first determination by the court is to look at the provisions and to determine whether the provisions are enforceable. And Forciere, as the secretary argued in his brief and has played out in the court's case law, albeit in non-precedential decisions, has clearly stated that any provision that is contrary to law, and Andrews tells us that this is contrary to law, as well as does the statute and the regulation, is not enforceable.
Well, and so I pointed out to appellant's counsel that you had included language saying that any statements made herein in the JMR shall not be construed as statements shall not be construed as interpretation of any statute, regulation, or policy. So now it seems like you're saying something different. You're saying that indeed this would violate the statute to implement the JMR as it reads. But in the actual language of the JMR, you included a statement that I think, at the very least, calls that into question. Essentially says that anything we say here is not an interpretation of law. So it wouldn't be an interpretation of 7113. I mean, if it's not an interpretation of 7113, how could it be contrary to the provisions of 7113?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, the Secretary's position wouldn't be that it has to interpret the statute in that JMR for the provision itself as it stands to be contrary to law. The fact of the matter is that statement is contrary to the statute, to the regulation, and according to the court's case law in Andrews, is an incorrect statement of law. And so the Secretary would disagree that the statement there, that it's not a general statement of his view of the statute or the policy, is not inconsistent. So again, but going back to the relevant case law that is applicable, the Secretary doesn't think that that changes the analysis. Again, the court's case law in Foissier clearly says that any provision that is contrary to law, and there's no question that that provision is contrary to the statute, to the regulation, and into the court's holding in Andrews, is not enforceable. But the Secretary would also add, even if the court was to disagree, at best, that would be an error that was committed by the board. But as the Secretary has argued in his brief, and has made the point again here today, any error in that regard is not prejudicial, given that appellant submitted a supplemental claim in November 2021 that has been adjudicated, that has been appealed, that further development was done, and now has been appealed to the board with a more fully developed record. And appellant has chosen the hearing docket again and has chosen to have a hearing and will be able to submit additional evidence and argument on these very issues. And so appellant has had the opportunity to be heard and has had this evidence heard. And so again, any error, which the Secretary does not concede that there's any error, is not prejudicial in this situation.
Mr. Scruggs, how long is it going to take for Ms. Bolts to get a decision on the supplemental claim, a final board decision?
Well, I cannot speak for the board, but what I can say about timing is appellant submitted that supplemental claim in November 2021 and received a decision, and that was with development. She received new medical opinions and received a decision just 4 months later in March 2022. And now, in just 6 months from the last time the appeal was before the court, she is back before the board awaiting a new hearing with a more developed record and another opportunity to submit additional evidence and argument on that more developed record.
Okay, so you don't know when she'll receive a board hearing and receive a board decision?
The best I can tell you today, Your Honor, is that all of that will be done in docket order, as is the board's obligation.
And her docket order is, remind me again how it works with the supplemental claim, if indeed the appellant files a what we'll call a timely supplemental claim after a final board decision?
So the docket order for that, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I didn't hear that. I'm sorry again.
Oh, how does docket order work?
Yeah, so her supplemental, her appeal of the supplemental claim was docketed in the order that it was, the appeal was received by the board.
Okay, so if we remanded, she would have an early docket number. I forget what the docket number. I'm not seeing it here, but at any rate, she'll have an early docket number. And with the supplemental claim, she would have the supplemental claim that she filed after receiving a final board decision. She would have a later docket number.
Procedurally, that is correct because it's two different streams. That's correct.
Uh-huh. And so that in the secretary's view is not sufficient prejudice.
Well, respectfully,
it's not as though she is going to be made whole necessarily, because there will be several years difference between the two docket numbers.
Well, respectfully, the secretary would disagree, Your Honors. A couple of points the secretary would make here. First, the court in Aviles Rivera has said that any potential delay in the system is not sufficient for prejudicial error. So the secretary would disagree on that point. The secretary would also disagree on the point about being made whole, because whole in this situation was the opportunity to have that evidence heard. In the particular claim stream that we are in here, there was no legal opportunity for that evidence to be heard. But she has now had that, not only that evidence heard, but additional developed. So she has a more developed record in the supplemental claim and has an opportunity to supplement that record. And then the last point I would just make, Your Honor, is because of the continuous pursuit feature of the AMA, there is also no prejudice in terms of being made whole, because if the claims were ever granted, then she would have the benefit of the continuous pursuit. So quite frankly, appellant's case is an example of the AMA system working.
Go ahead, Judge Peach.
I just want to clarify, on the supplemental claim, are they the exact same issues that we're on this case, or is there additional issues in the supplemental claim?
That is correct, Your Honor. They are the exact same issues that are on appeal in the decision here before you, when the issues were previously before the court and before the December 2021 joint motion for partial remand. Appellant submitted a supplemental claim on these same issues, as were her right under Federal Circuit's holding in MVA for these same issues.
And that means that she would benefit as well on the effective date portion.
Yes, according to 38 CFR 3.2500, which talks about continuous pursuit, all indications are everything is in continuous pursuit.
Thank you.
Which is the main reason the secretary continues to point out here that while the court should not find that an error was committed, even if the court was to find that, any error in this regard is necessarily harmless.
Thank you.
And Mr. Scruggs, I want to move to a topic that I discussed with Mr. Davis, and that is the fact that she is in the board hearing lane. And in the board hearing lane, as you well know, once there's a court remand, she'll go back to the board hearing lane. Now, as I quoted earlier, 20.700, I believe it's A, allows a claimant to receive a second board hearing for good cause, why wouldn't the language in the JMR be sufficient good cause here?
So respectfully, a few points, Your Honors. One, as you've noted, appellant made no requests for a hearing in any of the submissions. So that just one point, but
well, right, Mr. Scruggs, but she received, we were looking at the December 21st, 2021 letter, and it didn't mention anything about it.
That, and that was correct, and there's good reason for that. As the court noted in Andrews, all of the evidentiary windows closed prior to the initial board decision, and they don't reopen. And so there will be no further board hearing, even though that case returns to the board hearing docket, because the evidentiary windows closed, as the court recognized in Andrews, in all of the evidentiary windows, and they do not reopen. And so that's the exact reason why the board's letter does not include any notation that, because it is not a right for an appellant on remand in the AMA system.
And so even though there is this provision for a board hearing, for a second board hearing for good cause, and even though the appellant is returning, this is the secretary's position, even though an appellant is returning to the board hearing docket, which allows an additional board hearing for good cause, you're saying that regulation should have said you can get a second board hearing for good cause only if you request it before the evidentiary window as defined in Andrews closes.
If more specificity was needed, then I guess that could be correct, Your Honor. But yes, the Secretary's position is that that provision in 20.700, and again, the Secretary, that hasn't been raised in the briefing in this case, so we would be happy to, but in looking at it here, that is, it would be speaking to that option prior to the initial board decision on appeal, because as the court noted in Andrews, the evidentiary record windows close prior to the initial board decision, and they don't reopen.
So where would this case resume from then? Because initially, or earlier, appellate counsel said that it was his position that this case should go all the way back to September 2019 when the appellant chose the hearing lane. So what is the secretary's position as to where this, at what point would this case resume? Would it resume at the time they submit, that the board submitted the letter to the appellant saying you can submit more argument? Or, I mean, where would we begin? Or where would we take up the case again?
Thank you. Thank you for your question, Your Honor. And the secretary would agree with, I mean, disagree with the appellant's position. So appellant's position is contrary to the court's case law here. The court clearly stated in Andrews that the statute spoke to what happens on remand and that all of the evidentiary windows close. And so the regulations also speak to the case returning back to the same docket. So it would return back to its docket and its docket order. And then consistent with what we've seen here, there would be a 90-day letter, but that 90-day letter, as it did in this case, would only allow appellant 90 days to submit additional argument. And so that would be where the case would go upon remand from the court here.
Thank you.
And Mr. Scruggs, a question that I did pose to appellant's counsel. Would the secretary characterize 7113B as a procedural rule?
So again, and I just have to get it on the record, that is not something that was argued in this case, and perhaps it's something that would need more fleshing out. But on first blush, the secretary would disagree with that position because it speaks so heavily to the evidentiary record at the board. The secretary does believe that it affects the adjudicatory domain of the board such that it shouldn't be considered as just procedural. I think you're getting at potentially a claims processing rule. Is that correct, Your Honor, where you're going with your questioning? And if that's the case, even so, and even if the court would disagree on that point, those rules would have to be waived, and it's clear that there's no waiver here. Again, the language in the statute, in the joint motion for remand clearly says the secretary is not waiving any obligation or duties under the statute. The board's December 2021 letter clearly states that it's not waiving the obligations of the statute there. So that would be the secretary's position without having any additional time to flesh that out.
Thank you, Mr. Scruggs. Judge Greenberg or Judge Peace, do you have further questions?
I have nothing further, but don't be afraid to conclude, Mr. Scruggs. You're doing very well. Don't think you have to use every minute.
Thank you, Judge Greenberg. And I do not. I just want to make sure I answer all of your questions, sir. Because this is
I'm a fine situation. I understand your position very well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Judge Peach? Anything further?
Just a quick question on 7113, the statutory provision. Is there a CFR provision that goes along with this 7113?
Yes, Your Honor. It's 20.302. And the regulation mimics the statutory language.
And I take it that went through all the proper APA procedures required to have effective CFR regulations for the VA.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Mr. Scruggs, you may conclude unless you had another point here.
Thank you, Chief Judge. For the sake of completeness, two small points on the other issues here with respect to appellant's allegation regarding the weighing of the August 1987 service treatment record. The court should decline to include that as a basis of remand because the board's statements on that evidence demonstrate a permissible application of the law to the facts as argued in the secretary's brief. And with respect to the last allegation about the witness statements, the court should reject that contention as the board correctly noted that the relevant statute and regulation prohibit consideration of evidence outside of the pertinent evidentiary windows. Given that appellant's remaining arguments fail to meet her burden of demonstrating prejudicial error committed by the board in the decision on appeal, the secretary requests that the court vacate the board's decision and remand the issues consistent with the secretary's concession made in his brief.
Thank you, Mr. Scruggs. And Mr. Davis, you may begin with rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to begin by explaining that the prejudicial error Ms. Bowles faced in this case was not alleviated as a result of her filing a supplemental claim in November of 2021. The Secretary argued to you that her act of filing a supplemental claim was sufficient opportunity to be heard. But the December 2021 deal that she made with the secretary gave her the opportunity to be heard by an experienced VLJ who understands the law. When she filed the supplemental claim in November of 2021, she was heard by a VA employee who lacked the legal acumen to interpret the evidence and the argument necessary to decide this appeal. It's evident that that's the case because her claim was still denied and she's still waiting for her appeal at the court. As Chief Judge Bartley noted, The significant delay that she is waiting is the prejudicial error that she is facing here. If the board would have honored the December 2021 agreement that she struck with the secretary, she would have already had an experienced VLJ review of the materials and the evidence she submitted. The evidence that she submitted contradicts the findings of fact that the board made when they ignored the evidence that she submitted. That's the prejudice Ms. Bold's face here. And she's continuing to churn in the hamster wheel because the board did not honor the agreement that she struck with the secretary. I'd like to also point out to the court that in December 2021, when the secretary entered into this agreement with Ms. Bowles, Andrews had already been decided. The secretary had already argued this case to your court, and the secretary still included the language. Yes, the secretary argues today that for the first time, including that language was a mistake. Mistake or not, it was part of the deal that the secretary offered Ms. Bowles, and she relied on the promise in that deal when she made strategic options about how to pursue her claims. That is the prejudice Ms. Bowles faced here. Also, lastly, I'd like to point out to the court that our position that a remand from this court puts an appellant back to the same position that they were on day one when they filed their NOD is very much consistent with the holding that this court held in Andrews. Andrews was very strictly premised on the fact that that appellant was in the direct review docket. Under the direct review docket, appellants waive their right to submit additional evidence in return for the promise of a faster decision from the board. That was critical to the holding of Andrews. Even under Andrews, appellants in the direct review docket get sent back to day one in the process of the NOD when their case goes back down from this court. As a secretary's counsel admitted, the 90-day letter that the board sends everybody after this remand tells them that they have the opportunity to submit additional argument. That's exactly where an appellant on day one position would be if they were in the direct review lane. In the evidence submission and the hearing lanes, court should hold that after a remand from this court, appellants go back to day one and they get another opportunity to submit additional evidence. And they get another opportunity to request a hearing if they so desire with good. If the court doesn't have any other questions for me at this point, we'll go ahead and close.
Judge Peach or Judge Greenberg, do you have further questions?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Your Honors, Ms. Bowles and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you this afternoon. We respectfully request that you find that the board was required to consider the evidence she submitted after the December 2021 joint motion for partial remand, despite the temporal limitations set forth in the AA. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. And the court thanks both parties for their arguments. The case is submitted for consideration and court is adjourned.
Thank you. The court is in recess.